Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Knowledgeable.
Listen, here's what's wrong with your hypothesis, your theorem, your supposition, your postulate.
Honest.
If that front ain't in gangsta, your back end won't be able to show its full potential.
Understanding.
You're going to suck. You're going to suck for the next couple of years.
Passionate.
I'm all over social media. I live it.
This is the Kevin Sheehan Show on the Team 980 and the Odyssey app.
Hashtag facts.
It's the Kevin Sheehan Show. Now, here's Kevin.
Toss to Pollard. And there he goes. Tony Pollard down the sideline. Jets are on. Touchdown, Dallas. 58 yards, and Tony Pollard just showed the world how fast he is.
You know, that's really the play of the game last night. In what was kind of an ugly game for the most part, Dallas wins it 27-17. And Tony Pollard, in a 13-10 game late in the third quarter, goes 58 yards for basically one of the only decent runs of the night, other than C.D. Lamb's little reverse that Dallas had. And the Cowboys win 27-17 with, at times, impressive defense, but, of course, against an offense that has just been ravaged with injuries in New Orleans. And with a quarterback, Brendan, you probably remember the contract he signed, but whatever it was, it would appear to have been too much. Because Taysom Hill last night threw four interceptions in the game. Dallas wins 27-17, a result, by the way, that helped Washington last night. Either result was going to help Washington and anybody else last night in the wild card race. New Orleans was 5-6. They fall to 5-7. And remember, New Orleans is one of those teams that Washington, in a head-to-head, if it came down to a two-team tiebreaker for a playoff spot, would not win that tiebreaker. They lost to the Saints earlier in the year. So the Saints fall to 5-7. Had they won the game last night, Washington would have temporarily been knocked out of the 7 seed, because the Saints would have been at 500. It doesn't help the division race, but remember, Washington just two games back of the Cowboys in the loss column, with two games left against the Cowboys. And the Cowboys' next game is in Washington a week from Sunday at FedEx Field. And I'm already starting to wonder, if Washington were to win on Sunday, would that be, Brendan, beyond the Dallas fans that have already purchased tickets? Because I know that for a fact. I was told that earlier in the year, that the Tampa Bay and the Dallas games were going to be the games in which they would have the most fans, and, you know, a lot of the fans at the game would be rooting for the opponent. So you already have a lot of Dallas fans that have purchased tickets. But could we see something approaching next Sunday with a win over the Raiders, something approaching a sellout, with a lot of Washington fans in attendance as well? I think we might for that one. A Sunday, December, Washington on a roll, the Cowboys. We'll see. They got to take care of business with the Raiders on Sunday. We've got a busy show today. I'll have my keys to a win over the Raiders, a smell test later on in the show. Ben Standing, our Washington football team insider, with last-minute thoughts, injury updates, et cetera, at 7:35. Ron Rivera at 8. And then before all of that, I failed to mention that at 7 a.m. this morning, 1 hour from now, Cole Holcomb will be our guest. So Washington linebacker Cole Holcomb will be on the show an hour from now. We'll talk to Cole about the defense, the defensive improvement, etc. So Dallas wins last night. Look, I kind of lost a little bit of steam late in the second half. They win it 27-17, but Brendan, I thought it was an ugly game, and I thought Taysom Hill, what is the money they gave him? What was that contract that he signed?
So it was like one of those ridiculous, I think it was like a 4-year, like $95 million deal, but it was almost all incentives. So I'm trying to look up the specifics right now, but I think it boiled down to like a $10 million contract or $15 million contract.
I mean, Sean Payton loves himself some Taysom Hill. And I mean, who are we from afar after watching last night and a few other games? There have been games where I've been like, man, that dude is dual threat and dangerous. And he rushed for 100 yards last night. He gave the ball away 4 times in the game with picks. He was 19 of 41. By the way, I thought Dallas's pass rush, once again, was pretty decisive and pretty lethal. And DeMarcus Lawrence, was back last night. And I thought he looked really good early in the game. Micah Parsons, of course, is having right now an easy, I think, NFL Defensive Rookie of the Year campaign. He had another sack and had multiple quarterback hurries in the game last night. But again, that's a New Orleans offense that's dead to left right now. So I don't know how you judge that. The Cowboys gave up 36 to the Raiders on Thanksgiving night. Now, they got a little bit healthier last night, but they win the game. I don't know if you're a Cowboy fan, if you walk away from that thinking, this looks like my team from earlier in the season. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, kind of.
Did you stay up and watch the whole thing or not?
No, I didn't. Okay. I fell asleep. I went to bed at halftime.
Yeah,
so
I started. I lost steam in the second half as well, and it was close, and I did catch the Pollard run, and it did feel like a very winnable game in the moment for New Orleans at 13-10. You know, they had kicked a field goal early in the second half to draw to 13-10, and they'd gotten a quick 3-and-out and had, you know, the ball down 13-10, and then Dallas gets the big run from Pollard, which was the big offensive play of the night, really, from a rushing standpoint. Before that, they really struggled to run the football. He was like 6 for 12 yards, and Elliott ended up, you know, being 13 for 45. They end up rushing for 146 yards, and I know people will say, well, you know, the 58-yard touchdown run and the 33-yard reverse for CeeDee Lamb does count. It does. But 146 total rushing yards, and 91 of them came on 2 carries, including one on a reverse to Lamb. So you have that as part of the rushing yards. They really struggled, but everybody has struggled to run the football really against New Orleans. Throwing the football against New Orleans has been easier. You know what I didn't realize, I'll be honest with you, until Church said this to us yesterday, that Marshawn Lattimore was not having a good season. I'm a Marshawn Lattimore fan, just haven't watched a lot of the Saints this year. I thought Lattimore played pretty well when they played Washington, if you recall, in their win here earlier in the season. That was a game in which it wasn't like he was matched up the entire day against Terry McLaurin, but I thought he had a pretty good game that day. But apparently he has been up and down, and the guys on the broadcast last night talked about it as well. The Cowboys get the win 27-17. Elsewhere, by the way, I have to mention this, because I doubt any of you know what happened in the NBA last night. A record was set in an NBA game last night. Memphis beat Oklahoma City last night by an NBA record, 73 points. The final score was 152-79. That 73-point margin in last night's Memphis win over Oklahoma City is the largest in NBA history, topping Cleveland's 68-point win over Miami in 1991. the Cavs beat the Heat in 1991, 148-80. last night, 152-79. The biggest lead in the game was 78 points. At one point, with about 3 or 4 minutes left in the fourth quarter, Memphis led Oklahoma City 145-67. They were bordering on an 80-point lead in an NBA game. If you, you know, are just listening to some sort of news or show or sports center and somebody just says, yeah, the Grizzlies beat the Thunder last night, 152-79, do a double take. It's worth it because it's never happened before. The score at halftime was doubled up. It was 72-36 Memphis at halftime. So they had a 36-point lead at halftime in the game. If you're wondering about the particulars of the game, the Grizzlies shot 62.5% from the floor. They were 60 of 96 from the floor. They were 19 of 36 from behind the arc, 52.8%. And they didn't shoot that many free throws. It was something like 13 made free throws in the game. The big disparity is they out-rebounded Oklahoma City 53-26 in the game. Every single player on the team obviously played, and they ended up with 9 players in double figures. 9 of the 13 players that played ended up in double figures in the game. There you go. 152-79 in an NBA game last night. Also, on the more positive side, Phoenix won an 18th straight game in the NBA. They are rolling, and they get the rematch with Golden State, and I think that game is tonight. It is on ESPN late night, though. They beat the Warriors the other night. Now they'll play the game in San Francisco. They play the Warriors tonight. And they are 6.5-point underdogs, Brendan, in that game with an 18-game winning streak. Golden State, a 6.5-point favorite. They appear to be right now easily the two best teams in the NBA, both of them with incredible records. Phoenix at 19-3, Golden State at 18-3. And again, Phoenix has won 18 games in a row. For those of you that didn't pay attention, they were the NBA champion runner-ups last year to the Milwaukee Bucks. The Caps lost last night, and that's a second straight loss for the Caps. They lost in a shootout, so they get a point last night. But it's a it's two straight close losses to the Panthers and Blackhawks after a great weekend last weekend, beating Florida and Carolina. The Caps continue, you know, to stay right there at the top of the standings in their division with 34 points, and they've got a little bit of clearance between them, the Rangers, and Carolina, who have 31 points. So there you go. There's your scoreboard update for the night. But how about that? 152-79. That's hard to do, man. It's hard to almost lead an NBA game by nearly 80 points. They were almost up by 80.
I mean, the Thunder are tanking hard, and they sat Shai Gilgeous-Alexander last night. So
he was out.
They're one actual good player.
Really good player. Do you know that Aaron Wiggins has actually played some this year for the pro team, for Oklahoma City's actual team, not their G League or D League or whatever league team they have. But Oklahoma City is terrible, really bad. And they had a very, by the way, they had a very close game and had a legitimate chance to beat the Wizards last week, losing by 2 in that game. All right, we got a lot of football to get to. When we come back, I've got a couple of what do you gots to start the show, including something that Brent Musburger said yesterday in an interview about the John Gruden email situation. You'll want to hear that. Also, Brian Kelly was introduced as LSU's football coach 2 days ago in a press conference. And then last night, he introduced himself to the LSU faithful at a basketball game. And all of a sudden, Brian Kelly is a Southerner. Who knew? You'll hear what he said next. Lots of football to get to this morning. It's a Kevin Sheehan Show, the Team 980, the team980.com. We're also on the Odyssey app.
All right. What do you got?
So Brian Kelly's the new head coach at LSU, as we know. It's still amazing to me, the quote from Kelly the other day, talking about wanting to be under the big Broadway lights on the big stage at a place where you can win championships, and he was the head coach at Notre Dame. That really is still, to me, amazing, and maybe it's just a factor or a result of being a long time and an older college football fan. But as I said yesterday, Notre Dame's not the SEC. And Notre Dame, I think, really messed up by not joining a conference, the Big Ten specifically, when they had the opportunity to do it. I think ultimately Notre Dame has become less than what Notre Dame was because they haven't been in a conference. The SEC is the place to be in college sports, period. There's nothing that comes close to SEC football. Money-wise, pressure-wise, intensity, big games week in and week out, best venues, the whole nine yards. The SEC is the crown jewel of college sports, SEC football, and Brian Kelly knows it. And as crazy as it sounds for him to say that Notre Dame, for all intents and purposes, was an off-Broadway production and LSU is a Broadway production, it's probably true. Now, Notre Dame could end up in the Final Four when we get to Sunday morning, depending on what happens tomorrow morning. And he won't be coaching. The defensive coordinator who got the head coaching job will be. Anyway, he's excited to be at LSU. I wanted to mention one other thing. For Notre Dame people, this was expected. For Notre Dame, the Notre Dame athletic director and the Notre Dame brass, they knew Brian Kelly was ready to move on. He had a hell of a run at Notre Dame, but he was ready to move on. But who knew that he would say that it was for much bigger and much better? Anyway, he was introduced at an LSU basketball game, not last night, but two nights ago. Brian Kelly is a Midwesterner. You know, Brian Kelly, I could be wrong. Brian Kelly perhaps, lived in the South at some point. But he's been in the Midwest for a long time. I mean, he grew up in Massachusetts, so he's a Northeasterner by trade. And you can hear that more often than not in his voice. But he's been at places like Grand Valley State, Central Michigan, Cincinnati, and then took the job at Notre Dame in 2010. He hasn't spent enough time, I don't think, in the South to have a Southern accent. But listen to the way he addressed the LSU faithful at the LSU basketball game the other night.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, this is a great way to get started. To be a Tiger. I'm here with my family, and we are so excited to be in the great state of Louisiana, but more importantly, to be with you great fans, and to be part of what is going to be an incredible ride here at Louisiana State University.
So, you can hear him doing his best to do kind of a Southern. The Tiger, when you hear him say Tiger, that's got not only a little Southern, but it's got a little Cajun Southern in it.
It's the family for me, the family.
Let me hear the family part again. Can you give me just the family part? Take your time, because later on...
To be a Tiger. I'm here with my family, and we are so excited.
My family. Yeah. Wow. I know people like that, by the way. I had a couple of friends. I had a friend that went to Texas. I had a friend that went to LSU and Ole Miss. And they always kind of came back with a little bit of a Southern accent. I'm like, that's not your accent. Yeah, but I was down there for 4 years, and this is what happens. He hasn't been down there for 4 days yet. Now, later on in the speech, he veers away from the Southern accent, which I don't even know. I think he's trying to do a little Cajun in there as well. Tiger is more Cajun. You know, Louisiana Parish is more Cajun than just Southern. This is Brian Kelly a little bit later on in the speech.
We knew that coming in. We don't apologize for it. We know it's hard work. We know there's great teams in the SEC. We respect them. But this is LSU. Go Tigers!
It's not Go Tigers. It's Go Tigers. Pat Forty, one of the all-time, long-time college football, college basketball writers, said, reminds me of when Montana native Bobby Petrino suddenly became, reminds me of when Montana native Bob Petrino, all right, he was always known as Bob Petrino, suddenly became Bobby when he was hired as offensive coordinator at Auburn. A lot of people weighing in on Brian Kelly's accent.
Kevin, if you'll allow me, I actually found who he was modeling his accent after.
Okay.
You've got this kind of like Florida panhandle thing going, whereas what you really want is more of a Savannah accent, which is more like molasses just sort of spilling out of your mouth.
Oh, now do the Swedish chef.
I'm not familiar. What province is he from?
He lives on Sesame Street, dumbass.
Andy Bernard special. Yep. There's been a murder down here in Shreveport. Was it Shreveport? I forget where it was.
I think it was Savannah.
Savannah. Been a murder down here in Savannah. He talks with a little Savannah accent. That's one of my very favorite episodes when Jim and Michael are very much at odds because the company may be going under. And Jim's panicked and Michael... This is where, by the way, The Office was brilliant, Brendan, where they show Michael to be competent. You know, and this was the difference between the British series and the American series. Ricky Gervais playing David Brent was always a total 100% dunce. Michael Scott was pretty much 90% dunce, but occasionally they would give you this little glimpse of, oh, so that's why he's in the position he's in. Because he was the one that was calm during that whole thing. He was the one that diverted their attention. It's just like the episode The Client, when he and Jan go to sell the the school board guy on being their paper supplier. That was the first, I think that was season two. That's the first time you get that kind of feeling that Michael isn't a total dunce. I love that episode. Brian Kelly doing his best to fit in. Nothing wrong with that. I wonder how he'll do. Like, part of me thinks this could be like 3 years and done, and part of me thinks that he's going to win big. I think he's a hell of a coach, by the way. I really do. And I don't think Ed Orgeron was a hell of a coach. Brent Musburger is one of the significant equity holders in the VSiN network. The VSiN network is the gambling network based in Las Vegas, and they've got a lot of programming out there, and they do primarily gambling shows around the clock. Tim Murray, our old friend here from 980, hosts one of their shows in prime time. I think he hosts the 7 to 10 West Coast show. It runs 10 to 1. Here on the East Coast. And Aaron Oster, who was a longtime producer here at the station and produces my podcast, produces Tim's show. They all live out in Vegas, and they're working for the VSiN Network. All the shows, by the way, are done from that new Circa sports book, which I've heard is just amazing. Brent was on a show yesterday. Was this with Schefter, by the way?
No, this was on the JT and Looney podcast.
Okay, I'm not familiar with that podcast. So this was Brent Musburger on a podcast yesterday talking about the John Gruden forced resignation based on all of those emails. Remember, Brent is the play-by-play radio voice of the Las Vegas Raiders. He'll be doing the game on Sunday as the radio voice of the Raiders. Brent, for me, is one of the all-time broadcasting legends. There isn't anything that Brent Musburger did, in my opinion, that he wasn't great at. Play-by-play, hosting, doesn't matter what he was doing, Brent was always one of the best, if not the best of all time. I don't know that I've ever, in broadcasting, I don't know if there's anybody who's ever been as versatile as Brent. He's just as good doing basketball, football, and baseball. He's just as good doing it on radio or TV. Doesn't matter. Anyway, this was Brent talking about the Gruden forced resignation, the emails that caused it. He's pretty opinionated on it, but listen carefully to what he says and how it ties back to Washington.
First of all, as I told Coach, whoever took you out, John, that was a paid assassin, okay? That was one of the best hit jobs that I've ever been around, okay? They didn't go to their media goombas. They didn't leak this to Adam Schefter or one of those guys who breaks stories. They first went to the Wall Street Journal. And when Gruden was still coaching after that, then they dumped the rest of it on the New York Times. That was a professional hit job, but I want to tell everybody that I'm not completely sure it was somebody in the NFL. There was a second lawsuit involved, okay, between the owner, Snyder of Washington, and a former general manager. And that means that a lot of outside people had access to those emails.
Yeah, and he went on to say, you know, outside people had access to those emails that they were going through. He goes, I think the hardest part for Gruden's lawyers to prove is that somebody from the National Football League actually leaked that. Because if it is somebody from the NFL, shame on them, because Mark Davis should have been told during the summer when he had something to do with it. Look, I think that Jay Gruden, John Gruden, the Grudens all believe deep down that somehow this came from Washington in an attempt potentially to smear Bruce Allen. When Musburger says there was a second lawsuit involved, remember, this was the Snyder-Bruce Allen lawsuit. These emails were part of a discovery motion in an Arizona court. And when Brent says that means a lot of outside people had access to those emails that they were going through, he's trying to indicate to you it may not have been the league. And I think a lot of people believe that the leak of those emails maybe didn't come from the league. There are so many theories here. You know, there are the theories that it came from the league because they wanted Demora Smith reelected, and the election of Demora Smith happened to have been at the same time. And the comments about Demora Smith in those emails from John Gruden elicit some sympathy, and that Demora Smith would be reelected and that would be better for the league. You know, that's one of the theories about the emails. Now, Demora Smith, you know, from the league's perspective, it's not just that they think that Demora Smith doesn't do a good job or somehow a doormat. They actually, when you read into the league's relationship with Demora Smith, I don't know how much respect or how much they fear in negotiations with Demora Smith, but I know that they all feel like they're able to work with him. You know, and that hasn't always been the case. They're able to communicate and they're able to work with him. And so there was some sense that they really wanted Demora Smith reelected and that somehow it was going to be a close vote, which it was supposed to be, and that leaking these emails, even if it meant John Gruden gets fired, by the way, a high-profile coach in a high-profile right now market with a team that was doing well. Like, the whole situation, Gruden in Vegas, was a pretty good situation for the league. Now, if they were sitting on those emails and they knew what existed in those emails, they were taking a risk that those emails would come out at some point down the road anyway. But to Brent's point, they should have presented those emails to Mark Davis when they knew what was in those emails and let Mark Davis act accordingly when they knew what was in those emails, which was long before that weekend. So that's one theory, that they were dropped in an effort to sort of get Demora Smith reelected. There are other theories that just there were people in the league or people who had access to these emails that just had a grudge against John Gruden or had a grudge against the emails, had a, you know, visceral reaction to the emails and decided to leak them themselves to the Wall Street Journal and to the eventually later that weekend to the New York Times. And then there is the theory that Brent alludes to, that somebody in the case involving Snyder and Bruce Allen leaked those emails. They had access to those emails. Andrew Beaton, the writer for the Wall Street Journal, the first one to break the original email that we heard about, which was the John Gruden email where he talks about Michelin-sized lips on Demoris Smith. That was the first email we heard about. It was written about by Andrew Beaton in the Wall Street Journal, who just coincidentally had written a story a couple of months earlier on Dan Snyder and the big-time turnaround in Washington. It was an absolute puff piece, one of the all-time puff pieces ever written on Daniel Snyder. We talked about it last June. It was as if this guy didn't do any research at all and just took Washington's perspective on Snyder or Snyder's perspective on Snyder as gospel. It made Snyder look like, wow, this guy's really turned it around after being absent for so many years and letting his franchise go to hell in a handbucket, like he had nothing to do with any of it. So that was a link that Beaton, Wall Street Journal, written the puff piece, then all of a sudden he gets the email on Gruden. Now, what would be the motivation? Well, we've talked about it. You know, Dan hates Bruce. Dan believes that Bruce, along with Dwight Schar in particular, was involved in the attempted smear campaign against Snyder back in the summer of 2020, before the Post stories came out. The stories and the internet rumors that were out there tying Snyder to people like Jeffrey Epstein and to activities like drug trafficking and sex trafficking and all of those rumors that were unfounded and weren't true, but came out prior to the Post story. Bruce is believed by the Snyder camp to have had a hand in that. So impulsive as he is, without thinking about who ends up being damaged by it collaterally, he went after Bruce to try to make Bruce look bad by being a part of these emails that were involved with Gruden, thinking, I'm sure, like he's always thought, well, now the fans will really understand that it wasn't my fault that we sucked for so long. It was Bruce's fault, and he was the bad guy. So that's the other theory. It is interesting that Beaton, who writes this incredibly positive piece on Snyder in June of 2021, is then the one that gets access to the first email. And then the other emails ended up with the New York Times. And by the way, I don't think that Snyder cared about John Gruden being, you know, submarined by emails from an investigation that had nothing to do with him to begin with. By the way, I was thinking about the whole RG3 thing yesterday. I wonder if RG3's in any of these emails. I wonder if part of the book will be some of the emails. Who knows what's coming in that book? Anyway, Musburger, who is close, obviously, to the Raiders, because he works for the Raiders, he calls their games. I don't know if he's an employee of the Raiders or not. You know, some of these play-by-play positions are independent contractor status, and some of them, you're employees of the team. You know, Larry Michael was forever an employee of the team. I think Bram, I don't know this for a fact, I think he's an employee of the team. I could be wrong. But Musburger obviously has a close relationship with the Raiders, with Mark Davis, with John Gruden when he was the coach. And he thinks this was big-time hit. Paid assassin. They didn't go to Schefter. They went to the Wall Street Journal. They went to the New York Times. He called it a professional hit job, but very much questioned whether or not that hit job was done by the league. I don't know if we're ever going to find out. Certainly John Gruden wants to find out. John Gruden's going after everybody. And because of that, we may ultimately find out the source of those emails. Who leaked the emails? I think from our perspective, it would be important to find out if it was somebody associated with the Snyder camp, somebody associated with that case in Arizona from the Snyder side. It certainly wouldn't have been from the Bruce Allen side. Bruce is super close with the Grudens. All right. Cole Holcomb's going to join us at 7. Ben Standing at 7:35. Ron Rivera will be our guest at 8. Got a smell test coming up on the show today. We've got Washington beats the Raiders if. Couple of other NFL notes when we come back. Kevin Sheehan Show, the Team 980, the team980.com. We're also on the Odyssey app. Become a weekend warrior at BetMGM, guys. King of the Weekend is a free-to-play challenge where you can win up to $50,000 for correctly picking the highest-scoring pro football teams during the weekend. Simply log into your account and find the King of the Weekend contest in your promotion section. Then pick the six teams you think will score the most points from the selected games. $1,000 will go to the top entry each week. And if you guess all six in the right order, the grand prize of $50,000 could be yours. Plus, hundreds of dollars in free bets will be awarded to players who come close to a perfect score. Go to your account and try the King of the Weekend free-to-play game. New to BetMGM? Download the app today and make weekend football even better. Only at BetMGM, the king of sportsbooks. Visit BetMGM.com for terms and conditions. Must be 21 or older. D.C. and Virginia only. Please gamble responsibly. If you've got a gambling problem, call 1-800-522-4700.
It's Kevin Sheehan on the Team 980 and the Odyssey app.
We forgot to do something on Wednesday's show, which was our 1991 look back. I think we just got a little off schedule this week with the Monday night game. Real quickly, the 1991 team, 30 years ago, December 1st, was trying to bounce back off its first loss of the year, a loss to the Cowboys. They went out to Anaheim. That's where the Rams played then, in the Angels stadium. John Robinson, a good friend of Joe Gibbs, was the coach of the Rams. That Rams team was not an Eric Dickerson team. It was a Jim Everett, Marcus Dupree team. Marcus Dupree was the running back. It was not a good Rams team. They came into the game 3-10. The Rams came into the game at 3-9. Washington came in at 11-1. And Washington, after losing to Dallas the previous week, had just a 7-6 halftime lead. And all of a sudden, there was a brief feeling that, something's going on now. The juggernaut that was a team that had scored 97 points in two straight wins going into the Dallas game now was struggling to score. But they opened it up in the second half. Rippon hit a couple of bombs, including a touchdown pass to Ricky Sanders, and they won going away 27-6. 30 years ago this week, the 1991 team moved their record to 12-1 with an easy win, second half win over the Rams. And they clinched the division that day, beating the Rams with still three regular season weeks left. So there you go. That was the 1991 team from a year ago. So tomorrow is Championship Saturday in college football. And I mentioned yesterday, I think at the end of the show, that the college football rankings make this thing pretty easy if chalk holds tomorrow. And there are some big favorites in these championship games. Michigan's an 11-point favorite in the 11-point favorite in the Big Ten title game over Iowa. Cincinnati's a 10.5-point favorite over Houston, who has not lost since an opening weekend loss to Texas Tech. Houston has won 11 straight games. They play Cincinnati, and yet they're a 10.5-point dog in their league championship game. Georgia's a solid 6-point favorite over Bama, which, by the way, the public's lined up on Georgia for the SEC title game. And Oklahoma State is a 5.5, 6-point favorite over Baylor in the Big 12 championship game. So if chalk holds, if the favorites win tomorrow, you're going to end up with Georgia, Michigan, Cincinnati, and Oklahoma State. There won't be any debate. Those will be the four. Notre Dame's not getting in front of Oklahoma State. Notre Dame really doesn't have a signature win this year. The closest thing they have to a signature win would have been over Wisconsin, but Wisconsin didn't even make it to the Big Ten title game. They lost to Minnesota last week. And they lost to Cincinnati, who would be bounced out with a loss to Houston. So Oklahoma State's already ranked ahead of Notre Dame at fifth in the college football playoff rankings. So the the conversation, about who would be in the Final Four, who would make the college football playoff, is really simple if all the favorites win tomorrow. It would be Georgia, Michigan, Cincinnati, Oklahoma State. Georgia, Michigan would be the obvious number one and number two seeds. And then I'm not sure if Cincinnati would move up to the three seed or if Oklahoma State would jump them into the three spot and Cincinnati would be the four spot. It might be based on, you know, how they win and how impressively they win over the weekend. So it's pretty cut and dry from that standpoint, if chalk holds. But there is a chance for chaos like we haven't seen in a long, long time if you get a bunch of upsets tomorrow. Brendan, follow along because you've got to play this game with me. Are you paying attention?
Yes.
Okay. So let's assume that Georgia wins big over Bama. Okay, they win big over Bama. It's a no-brainer. Georgia finishes 13-0, SEC champs. By the way, the only given for the playoff as we speak right now is Georgia. They're the only one that is locked and loaded, and definitely, no matter what happens tomorrow, they're in. So let's just assume for a moment that Georgia wins, and then chaos happens everywhere else. Baylor loses. Baylor beats Oklahoma State in the Big 12 title game. Michigan loses to Iowa in the Big 10 title game. Cincinnati loses to Houston in their conference championship game. Who the hell gets in? There's one team that would be obvious after Georgia if all of that happens. Michigan loses to Iowa, Cincinnati loses to Houston, and Oklahoma State loses to Baylor. There's one team that jumps into the top four, and there's no debate, and that would be Notre Dame, who doesn't play this weekend. They would jump into the top four as a one-loss team. And then trying to figure out the other two, they would all be coming from a list of two-loss teams. You would end up with two teams in the Final Four with two losses. And it would be between Baylor, who would be a Big 12 champ and would have just beaten Oklahoma State. Ohio State would be back in the mix as a two-loss team that didn't play in their conference championship game. Michigan, even though they lost, would still be in consideration if all of those other things happened. A two-loss Alabama team would still be in consideration even if they got pummeled by Georgia. And by the way, Alabama, more than any of these teams, believe it or not, doesn't pass the eye test, which is totally ironic when it comes to Bama. A one-loss Cincinnati team, no chance. Okay, I think we can all agree that Cincinnati wins, they're in, they lose, they're out. There's no non-Power 5 team that's getting in with one loss. And then you go all the way down to, could Ole Miss as a two-loss team be in consideration? Could a Pitt as a two-loss ACC champion beating Wake Forest rise all the way up? No. The answers to that are probably no. You would then be selecting, I believe, from four two-loss teams, Baylor, Ohio State, Michigan, and Alabama for those other two spots. Did you follow along, Brendan, or not?
Yeah. So my assumption is Baylor would probably be the top of those two-loss teams.
Agreed. And I agree with that.
Probably Alabama.
That's where it gets dicey. Because I agree with you on Baylor. I think if Baylor beats Oklahoma State, despite the fact that Baylor lost to TCU just a month ago, okay, they lost to TCU on the road, they would have avenged their other loss, which was to Oklahoma State earlier in the season. So I think Baylor jumps into the top four. I'm on that one. I think Bama would get a lot of consideration because of brand. But I don't think that they would deserve it. I think Ohio State and Michigan both pass the eye test, and Alabama doesn't. They would all be two-loss teams, and Bama's losses would be to Georgia and to Texas A&M. Okay, two really good teams. But they barely beat Auburn. They barely beat LSU. Both of those games were games they were very lucky to win. And those are games in just the last month. They actually had a very close game with Arkansas 2 weeks ago. Meantime, Ohio State, before last weekend, I think a lot of people thought could win the national championship. You know, when they put up 500 yards and scored on seven straight possessions and had a 49-0 lead against the number seven team in America, Michigan State, the week before the Michigan game, Ohio State seemed like a cinch. Most people thought Ohio State would beat Michigan and that Ohio State and Georgia were going to play for the national championship. I think it would be Ohio State.
I think Ohio State's candidacy depends on whether or not Oregon wins the Pac-12 championship. Well, because
if they lose to Utah.
Yeah, if they lose to Utah on Friday night, that's kind of a dagger for Ohio State in the chaos scenario. I think Michigan probably holds on because they're not going to want to do Georgia-Alabama too in that 1-4 matchup.
Of the three teams, I think what you said about Oregon's true too. So let's just assume that part of the chaos is Oregon losing to, or Oregon, actually, Oregon's an underdog this week, aren't they? I mean, they got pummeled by Utah 2 weeks ago. I think Utah's a 2-point favorite. I forget what it is. Yeah, Utah's a 2.5-point favorite in this game. That's an interesting angle. If Oregon beats Utah, if they avenge their blowout loss to Utah, that makes Ohio State's loss. I just think that Ohio State-Oregon game, because it was so long ago, it's just a totally different Ohio State team. I guess from a number standpoint, it certainly strengthens their overall profile. That makes sense. But I don't think it changes the way the committee would look at the teams if Oregon wins or loses against Utah. I think we're right on Baylor. You know, in the chaos scenario, I think we are right on Baylor that they would join Georgia and Notre Dame. And then I think Michigan people would go nuts. Now, maybe, you know, the context of how Michigan loses to Iowa, like some sort of controversial 1-point loss, then it's Michigan over Ohio State in the chaos scenario. But if Michigan gets blown out by Iowa, I don't know. I think that they're going to believe that the Ohio State thing last week at Michigan, big house, the snow, that Ohio State's still the better team. And let's face it, if Ohio State played Michigan tomorrow, even though we saw what we saw last week, Ohio State would still be favored. You know, especially on a neutral field. They would be the favorite over Michigan. And, you know, I've gotten to the point where that conversation, because it seems to be a common conversation where people say, well, who'd be favored? Well, at this point, who really cares? I mean, Ohio State was a double-digit favorite over Oregon earlier in the year and lost by double digits. And they were, you know, an 8-point favorite over Michigan and lost by double digits. That should concern less. But it is part and parcel to the way the teams are viewed, you know, subjectively by the committee. It would be... What time does that show come on? Is that 12? It usually is a noon thing on Sunday, right?
Yeah,
where they unveil the college football playoff. If that happens, that would be a wild show to see who teams 3 and 4 would be, and it'd be kind of cool to see, you know, Baylor in there along with. Well, look, if Cincinnati wins and all of the other chaos happens, you could end up with Cincinnati and Baylor, along with Notre Dame and Georgia. It would be a totally different feel. It's already going to potentially be a different feel anyway. By the way, I don't think Michigan's going to lose to Iowa. I think they're really, really good. I think Cincinnati could lose to Houston, though. Okay, when we come back, Cole Holcomb will be our guest on the show. 7:35, Ben Standig. 8, right here, as he joins us every Friday, the head coach of the Washington football team, Ron Rivera. It's the Kevin Sheehan Show on the Team 980, theteam980.com. We're also on the Odyssey app.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with 3 rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.